I'll introduce Atria Bandhu, though he may need no introduction for some people, but he's written two collections of poetry. The Crumb Road was the first, and a poem from that collection actually won the Ledbury Poetry Competition in 2009, I think, when Billy Collins was the judge. Mm-hmm. And that poem became part of the Stevens sequence in The Crumb Road. And then his second collection is only out last year, is called Yarn. And on the back cover, he gives us the OED definition, which I think was lovely that that's there. Yarn, informal, a long or rambling story, especially one that is implausible. So since 1990, he has lived and worked at the London Buddhist Centre, teaching Buddhism and meditation. And he's written three books on Buddhism and now leads retreats. And we're actually going to have a second poetry and meditation retreat in July. Maitri Bandhu is also the founder of Poetry East, a place where you bring some of our foremost poets and chat to them, particularly about spiritual matters, I suppose. But and it's wonderful. He's such a good interviewer, a conversationalist. But you did say in one of these conversations that the first poetry readings you went to were awful. Naming no names or festivals. So and I think that is really interesting. And obviously the element of conversation as a way of bringing people into the poems or giving people away into the poems. So that's what we'll try and do tonight. So please come and join.
Thank you, Chloe. Thank you. I sometimes, just to give you a bit of interest. So this is a poem in a stanza pattern, so it's got a... For those of you who know, your matrix has got a set number of feet for each line, which repeat in that pattern each the way through. It's in a rhyme scheme, and it's in one sentence. And it took me about 4 years to write it, just because I'm not very good at it, you know. It took me about 4 years to write it, and with these little lyric things, you write them, especially with rhyme and meter and stanza patterns and so on. But they're actually very difficult to do. And then when you write them and when you read them out, people tend to say, oh, yeah, that's quite nice. That's about all you get from them. You just think, it took me forever to write. Anyway, so that's a little bit of background. Recently somebody said it was homiletic, like a homily, which I didn't like at all. Not supposed to be. It's called These Days. The sun at sunflower height makes the usual lanterns in the gorse. Pine twigs bright as Golgi's pictures of the brain, where nerves show up in silver nitrate, and although the breeze is just enough to nod the Queen Anne's lace, nothing pleases. Our human calculus precedes the given world. Whatever seeds we plant will grow in time, the error bred in the bone, the daily rancour of the mind. Our clever ways to be unkind will spoil the morning, disinclined as we so often are, to watch this equal sunlight sculpt the day, a repertoire of olive green and cinnabar, from risen moon to evening star. So hopefully you can hear the sort of stanza pattern form. What it does, it gives you this lovely, it should give you this sort of slightly dance-like feeling for it. So the sun at sunflower height makes the usual lanterns in the gorse, pine twigs bright as Golgi's pictures of the brain, where nerves show up in silver nitrate, and although the breeze is just enough to nod the Queen Anne's lace, nothing pleases. Our human calculus precedes the given world. Whatever seeds we plant will grow in time. The error bred in the bone, the daily rancour of the mind, our clever ways to be unkind, will spoil the morning, disinclined as we so often are, to watch this equal sunlight sculpt the day, a repertoire of olive green and cinnabar, from risen moon to evening star. So I think it should sound like that, this sort of skimming, dancing sound will finally take off at the end.
Nice.
Thank you. That's the most enthusiastic response I've so far. And she's a friend, so that kind of spoils it.
It is interesting, that question of reading a poem again at a reading. As you were reading that parts of it again, I thought, that practically never happens, does it, at a poetry evening? The poet gives you the poem once, and then you hope you we're able even to concentrate during that. Yeah, yeah. But quite often, sometimes even that's hard to do. I wish everybody would give us the poem.
It's interesting, when I interviewed Alice Oswald, that's what she did. She read everything. She memorises all the poems, and then she'd read them sort of from A to R, and then read them backwards again. She could memorise them all, then read them in any order. And then she could memorise a whole collection. That wonderful collection. She said, would you like me to say the whole book, or I can do the first bit or the last bit, without notes. Incredible.
Yeah.
But yeah. I'm not able.
You finished the last poem with a kind of evening. The last poem is an evening poem as well,
yes,
isn't
right,
it,
yeah.
In the collection? So you begin with an evening and then end with an evening. Do you want to do that, to give poem?
Yeah,
so we can hear.
I mean, the idea, and everybody thinks this first poem is an evening poem, it's actually, in my mind, a morning poem. The sun at sunflower height makes the sun rising. But yes, you do get into evening star, so I don't know.
Yes.
Okay. So it's
under. But it moves very quickly from risen moon. Yes, risen moon to evening. Yeah, okay.
A lot of people think it is evening. Anyway, this is. So the idea was it started with sunrise and finished at sunset. But an idea that doesn't work.
It does definitely start at sunrise.
Yes, it does start at sunrise.
It brings you to evening star.
The word evening star does suggest evening, doesn't it? So this last one is called Owl Night. It's a Terzerima sonnet, for those of you interested in forms. So Terzerima, if I had a clipboard, it rhymes A-B-A and then B... C, B, so it's a linked rhyme. The Divine Comedy is all in Terzerima. And what Terzerima does, I've got two poems in Terzerima, what it does, because the rhyme is linked, it has this strong forward motion to it. It sort of keeps moving forward. Perhaps I might read it later on, this other one in Terzerima. And then you have to kind of tie it up at the end. Ode to the West Wind, for instance, Shelley's poem, is in Terzerima sonnets. It has a particular sort of feel to it. But it's actually very difficult to do because English is a rhyme poor language, and you need three rhymes for each word. I mean, I don't know why I write them. Nobody writes in rhyming. The one review I've had for this is terribly stinging about my rhymes. If you want to be cool, don't rhyme, is my suggestion. I'm sure you don't want to be, but. Strangely unfashionable at the moment. So this is the poem that finishes the collection. They say as well, if you're not sure whether to buy a collection, you just read the first one and the last one, and then you can just put it aside. That's what I'm told. Okay, so it's called Owl Night. All day the wind has ranged across the valley. It gave the pines their hour, thrashed their branches, milled their tops. But now the limestone ridges scoured into a milky non-existence. The day is sealed, the mountains tower beyond the pale, deleted distance. You can hear the birds arcade, the wind undoing its persistence. Nature's apple colours fade. I wash my cup and scrub a saucepan, then go to bed. The debt is paid. Consciousness is overrun. The owl's one hoot tells night to come.
Lovely. Okay, so there's a couple of things I suppose we could start with that I'd think about. Would you like to tell us about the shape of this collection and how it was planned, how it came into being?
Yes. I had this mad idea, and looking back on it, it was a bit mad. Frost, and one of my sort of great mentors, as well as sort of poetry mentors, is Robert Frost, the American poet Robert Frost. His great collection is his second collection, called North of Boston. He never wrote as good a single collection again. There's always great poems in Frost all the way through, but nearly every poem in that collection is a great poem. North of Boston is mainly long narratives and short lyrics, a few short lyrics, but wonderful long narratives. And I'd already started some long narratives, And I wanted a collection that was like that, mainly long narratives and short lyrics. It was going to have five long narratives in, two of which were cut at the end. So that's what I had, this idea of yarn, long narrative poems. Again, narrative poems are very unfashionable now, mainly because they're long. I think probably what will happen to this collection is people won't read them. They're about 9 pages long. And again, people tend to look and think, well, that's a bit long for me. But I was very inspired by Frost's long narratives. I think they're really quite wonderful and will survive everything, you know. So that was my sort of hubristic idea, was to have a collection mainly long narratives with these short lyrics that would sort of punctuate them. Two of them didn't just sort of fell apart. They all took a long time to write, particularly The Travellers from Orissa. It took me 6 years to finish it. You just want to get out of it, and I couldn't get out of it. I couldn't finish it. So I liked that. I was particularly wanted this title because yarn, a long rambling story, but yarn is also yarn of thread, and that links into my mind with the Buddhist word sutta, which also means thread. And the long narratives that I was writing at the time, before the conception of the collection came about, were long Buddhist poems, like modern suttas, which means thread. So I like this relationship between yarn, sutta, story. So that's really how it came about. Never quite worked out that I wanted all of them apart from the narratives to rhyme, and they don't.
Right.
I thought I wouldn't have any free verse in this, and I do. You tend to set off with some idea like that to form a collection around, and then gradually falls apart.
So the first part is has the Travellers of Orissa in it, doesn't it? And it feels to be quite strongly about these, as you say, Buddhist stories, I suppose.
Yes, they are, yes.
And did you sort of know that's what you were going to do? I mean, they're about meeting a teacher, the Buddha, and then and sort of this all feeling of missing something, or like a sort of presence that then goes and being left with your normal life, trying to go on with your normal life, which in a way I suppose is different to your experience because you're ordained, you've followed the path. So it's about people that didn't follow
I mean, it's interesting, you know, with writing. I mean, this is the first, it's only my second collection, but this is the first collection with overtly Buddhist poems in. I mean, the other collection, I'm hoping, is everything is Buddhist, but this is the first time I use the word Buddha, for instance, which I was rather shy of. You can't ever set down to write a poem for good reasons. You know, I think it would be good to have modern Buddhist stories, from my point of view, it would be good. But I can't write them for that reason. And both of the poems, long poems about the Buddha, meeting the Buddha at least, happened accidentally, as so often they do. You know, poetry has to catch you, and often it's an accident. So I was listening to a talk given by Subhuti, who's a good friend of mine and ours, he's a very senior teacher in the Triratna Buddhist Order. And he said, oh, in this talk I want to tell you the story of the travellers from Orissa. And just that phrase, the travellers from Orissa, I just thought, somewhere in the universe is a poem called The Travellers from Orissa. If it were, sometimes it's used, the merchants from Orissa. If it said, I want to tell you about the merchants from Orissa, I wouldn't have written the poem. It's just that the travellers from Orissa, it's so beautiful, isn't it? Immediately you think, that's a poem. And so he told the story. I'm afraid I wasn't then listening very much. I was having a poetry moment. Excuse me, let me out of here. I was having a poetry moment. So what I did is I went upstairs and I immediately started scribbling down this poem called The Travellers from Orissa. I never changed the title. And in fact, I think the first paragraph of the poem, I don't think I changed very much at all. I thought it was actually going to be in terse rima for a horrible moment, but luckily it wasn't. So I've started writing the poem. I thought I'd finished it quite quickly, and I showed it to Mimi Calvati, who I've dedicated the book to. And she said, she read it, and she said, yeah, I like it, but it wants to be much longer. And it was a really striking experience, because I remember thinking, well, that's it. She said, oh, look, you've finished the story in sort of midway. I finished it like in a, like 2 pages in, I think. Mm. And she said, you finish it in midway. He wants to tell the whole story. But I didn't know what the whole story was. You know, I mean, it's not what happened in the Buddhist suttas is that Tapusa and Balaka met the Buddha. The first people to meet the Buddha after he was enlightened, the first ordinary people to meet the Buddha. Yeah. They gave him a meal. They then took the 2 refuges rather than the 3 refuges and then travelled back to Orissa. What is interesting about that story is that there is a group of people in Orissa practicing something strangely like Buddhism, or at least they worship a god called Dharma. So there might be something in this story. So lots of people have been interested by them because there's some suggestion that something did happen.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to write their story, but I didn't know what it was. There isn't one.
Yeah.
And I had to find from what I'd written already what the story was. Mm. And it was sort of miraculous. The whole story is actually in the first paragraph, but it took me all of that time, literally, I think 6 years to finishing it, to find out what the story was.
Yeah.
But I could never have written it for good reason. I couldn't have thought it'd be good to write a Buddhist story about meeting the Buddha. It'd be good if it was like, no way, you can't ever write like that. Yeah. Even for the best possible reasons, you can't write like that.
No, and the people within the story of the poem don't know. There's a feeling they haven't grasped what's happened. The main character hasn't grasped what's happened to him at all. That's very strong.
And for a long time, I only called him the Master. Hmm. I actually showed it to Carol Rumers, I don't know, a very, very good poet and critic. And she said, I don't like this term, the Master, because it's a literary term. So then that provoked me to write another section in which he suddenly says all the names which are from a traditional Buddhist source. If you're a Buddhist, you read it knowing its references in a different way.
Yes.
But I wanted it to be a story for everyone, a modern story about meeting the Buddha. Yeah,
yeah. And, I mean, there's the other story. There's the story of the day book of, Li Shu Tong. You know, that's a really different sort of poem. It's absolutely lovely about earthiness, about the sort of this meeting between these two people in the poem.
Mm. It's interesting because nobody's noticed this one at all. It's called The Day Book of Li Shu Tong. I was hoping that people would actually think it was a translation from the Chinese, which of course it's not.
Yeah.
It's actually my way of talking about my experience on a particular retreat. It's very, very different.
Yeah, that's what it felt like. It felt like that might be the experience that you might have being on retreat of some. That's how I felt about it. Although it's very vivid about the place and the different, this very different kind of place and time.
Well, it's interesting because on the retreat I was on, we wear robes on retreat. You know, we meditate, obviously, we eat together, we live together. It's a men's retreat, so we have these little pee pits that you have to use. And to write it now, I couldn't do. But all you need to do is say it's in ancient China and Bob's your uncle. You hardly need to change a thing. You know, the odd name here and there, but otherwise it's pretty much the same. And you could talk about robes and Buddhas and, without... Otherwise, it's very odd to try and write it now, sort of thing.
Yeah.
I had this idea I'd write a book called that, but it hasn't happened.
Right. For me, it's interesting, and I watched a Maitri Bandhu chat with Michael Simmons Roberts, who's a Catholic. He's a Catholic, and he's also a poet. And in that conversation, you talked about sort of idea, and you should. I'll just prompt you, and then you might. So that there's a sort of place of belief. And there's a place of non-belief, and that there's a sort of metaphysical lightness about being in the middle, where you're a sort of, and I'm an agnostic person, so I'm in that middle place, and I was really interested in that, and I thought, and as I'm reading these poems, so I suppose I'd like to just hear you tell me more about your sense of these two places to be, and then this middle ground, which a lot of us perhaps are inhabiting at the moment, and...
Yes, well, it's very, for me, you know, it's central to my life. So when I was brought up in the Church of England, I once met the Archbishop of Canterbury, not the one of them, I can't remember which one it was, and someone said, I don't think you've met Maitri Bandhu. And he turned and looked at me and said, are you Tibetan? I said, no, I come from Henley Norton.
Do I look to them? Do you get out much? Anyway. So I was brought up in the Church of England. And I remember when I was in the church choir, and I remember singing Stainer's Crucifixion. I don't know whether you ever hear that anymore. I used to love it. And I remember singing, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son that he so believe in him. And I remember really wishing to believe, really even longing to believe, but knowing that I didn't. It's almost the issue of belief in God had already been decided before I became conscious almost. I just sort of knew I didn't.
In that God.
In that God. So you've got this sort of belief in Creator God. But then I've also been struck more recently by an increasingly virulent and even dogmatic secularism, and a new war between God on one hand and a rather sort of, you know, increasingly sort of strident secularism. It's become more ideological. And of course that gets, people even start to think that that's what Buddhism is, another kind of secularism. It's actually just not either. It's above and beyond, yes and no is how I sometimes, the yes of eternity, of God, of all of that, the literal yes. But it's also beyond the no of, you know, when you die, that's the end. This terrible sort of thing that people get into, that they really know about, you know, life and death. I remember talking to Don Patterson, and he was saying, there's no one here but us chickens. He was rather proud of that. Actually, he's rather influenced by Buddhism. But what I should have said to him is, how do you know? You don't know that there's no one here but us chickens. That's what you believe. So a lot of secular thought is really belief disguised as fact, if you see what I mean. So it becomes sort of, it's talked about as if, when you die, that's it, the end, and that's a fact. It's actually belief. No one knows what happens when you die. I don't, and you don't. Buddhism wants to say there's another way of looking at everything, which goes beyond the yes of divinity, of a supernatural aid, all of those things. It's saying, well, no, that's not true. But it goes beyond the no of the secular, of a life bounded by, bounded by a sleep. You know, Buddhism is trying to communicate something that's within us that goes beyond us, something that's within our egotism, our self sense, which actually reaches beyond that. And the whole of the path of Buddhism is a path beyond yes and no, is how I've been thinking about it recently. And the wars beyond yes, in yes, with yes and no. Buddhism wants to say there's just more than those, than that binary question.
Right. That's it. You've got in your poem soul, actually, is that?
Oh, yes.
That's
a good way in, isn't it?
Yeah, thinking of that as you were speaking. I don't know if you want to.
Yeah, why don't I read that? This is from a sequence of poems about my very close friend Mahananda, his death. The sequence in the book called April Elegies. Mahananda, I ordained into the Theravada Buddhist Order, is a very good friend of many of us. And, so it's got some of the more sort of, it's a very sad sequence, but there's this question about souls. It's probably one of the most sort of explicitly metaphysical poems in the collection. Souls. I don't believe that birds return to... Souls. I don't believe that souls return to birds. Watch them on the lawn. The blackbirds stub the muddy grass for worms. I don't believe that souls transform to deer that track us from a wood, remembering their former human forms. I don't believe that when the trumpet sounds, the soul is given back its mortal flesh as brightly burning coals. I don't believe the soul migrates and wears a different body with each life, or like a water drop dissolves. They say we each live on in the gestures of a child, but that doesn't count for you, no father to a son. So what can I conclude on your departure?
but nothing came of it. With everything, everything undone. So you see what I'm trying to do in that poem is, I don't believe this, I don't believe that. So I don't believe that souls are turned to birds, I don't believe that souls transform to deer. I don't believe that when the trumpet sounds, the soul is given back its mortal flesh as brightly burning coals, which is a traditional Christian Catholic thought. I got that from Dante, mainly, of course. I don't believe the soul migrates and wears a different body with each life, which is reincarnation, or with each life, or like a water drop dissolves. It's not that I believe that we sort of disappear into this oneness. They say, and then the secular view is they say we each live on in the gestures of a child, but that doesn't count for you, no father to a son. So what can I conclude on your departure? That nothing came of it, with everything, everything undone? And I want to leave it, because I don't know, so I'm not going to say, but what I do believe is a rebirth, as the Buddhists believe. But I can't believe that everything is undone. I remember when I was sitting with my father when he died, all I knew is that I couldn't talk to him anymore. But and in that moment when he died, my strong experience was that I didn't know what happened. But in a way that was much bigger than I usually don't know something. I didn't know what happened, including whether he had died in the sense in which we understand it. I felt confronted by an incredible mystery, but I couldn't think that everything was undone, which is our contemporary idea that your whole life, everything, your consciousness, everything undone. My instinct is that can't be right. Mm-hmm. And that was my way of trying. I mean, I didn't start off the poem thinking that's what I want to say. I actually just started off with, I don't believe that souls are turned to birds. I was looking at blackbirds. And a lot of poets talk about nature as if they've got souls in them. And I was just looking at these blackbirds. I think I've been reading John Burnside and thinking, well, I don't believe that, you know. Yeah. And that's where it started. I don't believe. And then, so what do I believe? Yeah. I don't believe that everything's undone.
Yeah, that's it. There's a lot to say about that sequence of poems, actually, isn't there, as well? But it is also just as sort of ghosts appear sometimes in your poems, yes, too, yeah, don't yeah. they? There's yeah. a beautiful poem, I think, in the first one, with when you're in the caravan with Stephen comes back.
I like ghosts, yeah.
Yeah, and your father has a story as well that he's ghosts. Obviously told yeah. you,
yes,
which
right.
is a very vivid, it's in this one, a very vivid ghost
Yeah, ghost
story,
story,
isn't
yeah.
it? That he must have told you many times.
Yeah. He said that's why it's to do with listening as well, which is why he said why he had big ears. Because he had been listening very much as a child and made him got big ears.
I mean, it's interesting that you're thinking of your father and the listening, because he appears again in this secret set of poems as well as in the first. And he was in your poems, you have him as a maker. Rescuing
yes.
tools, and
yes,
obviously
right.
you're a maker,
yes,
and the
yes.
craft of your poems is obviously very something you really, you know, is very important in Yuan.
Yes,
is it more important to you, is it becoming more important to you, this idea of the craft of the poems and the rhymes? You told a nice story about the poem Zofia with the rhyme. That a rhyme can. How a rhyme can help in writing,
yes.
you know.
I mean, I think the craft of a poem is, I've got more and more concerned with that.
Yeah.
It's weird, the poems I'm writing at the moment are mostly in free verse, so, you know, you can think you're concerned with something, only to stop being concerned.
Yeah, did you say we could say something?
Mm-hmm.
You're saying about undone.
Hmm.
Could I say, or could we say that the world, we don't believe that, if it's undone, so that means the world isn't completed then, it's undone. Does that come into it as well?
Yeah, what I want to keep reminding myself of is that we don't know about the reality of ourselves, and we don't know about the reality of the world. There is something
deeply mysterious about this being human in this world.
Definitely.
And I want to suggest that. I don't have answers, not in the poems at least, but I want to suggest that, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the task of poetry sometimes feels like that, searching for answers. I
think, yes, that's right. Yeah.
You know, for a lot of people who don't have a belief, who perhaps love poetry, so for me, poetry is almost a belief system that you go to for the things you find in a religion.
Well, you see that in Wallace Stevens. I'm rereading Wallace Stevens at the moment, and, you know, for him, he's trying to have poetry fulfil the place of belief.
Right, yeah.
But yes, this poem, Zofia, which is about Mohananda's mother. Well, what happened is I was cycling home from babysitting and I suddenly heard the music of the poem. I've been trying to write a poem about this dream I'd had about Mohananda, who appeared to me in a dream after he had died about a month later. He looked like he'd just come off a very intensive retreat and had been very challenged. And he threw his arms around me in the dream. And it was weird because I was dreaming about something else. Threw his arms around me and then tried to tell me what had happened since he died. But it all came out in one moment. So everything he said, I couldn't understand it because it's like saying everything but in one moment. So I'd been trying to write a poem about what he'd said. And I couldn't find it. This is my fourth attempt. Then I was cycling home and I had this sort of the music for it. Da 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 dum, da 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 dum, da 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 dum. And I remember very clearly because I was cycling, I'd been babysitting, and I thought, oh, there's a poem coming. This is. So, excuse me. And I nearly always try and carry a pad and a pen on me. And it sounds terribly pretentious, I know, but I didn't have one. But, oh my God! So I then had to cycle to a shop to buy a pad and a pen. And as I was buying the pad, buy a pen, I need a pen, I've got a poem coming. People out of the way in the shop, excuse me, poem coming. And it was going as I was... and I finally got there and I scribbled the first few lines down as it was disappearing. And the first thing I thought is, oh no, it's in rhyming couplets. I mean, we've all been there. We've been thinking something, you think, oh no, it's in rhyming couplets. I mean, we've all been there. But what's interesting, it just came to me in that form. But then, of course, you then start to work on the couplet, rhyming couplet, which is very, very difficult. It took me ages to do it. But what the couplet does, the rhyming couplet does, is it just takes you to the next rhyme. So it's not like a rhyming scheme. It just goes, you know, rhyme, rhyme, new rhyme, new rhyme, new rhyme, new rhyme. So it's got this very quiet, stately pace. And it's often used in elegy. Mm-hmm. So Tom Gunn's set of elegies, The Man With Knights, so it's all based around the rhyming couplet. Because the rhyming couplet has this very, particularly if it's in pentameter, it has this very sort of stately, slow music. And this sort of stepping forward. So I'll read it. It has this sort of stepping forward in the... Each rhyme is just like a step. So it has this sort of funeral march sort of feeling, especially if it's in pentameter, which gives it this sort of weight. And again, it took me ages to write. And it first of all became just a poem about the dream, but then wanted to be a poem because... Zofia, Mohananda's mother, was in Auschwitz. So as soon as I mention his mother, who I knew quite well, you have the whole history of Europe. You have, you know, some of the most terrible events in Europe. In fact, there's a poem later on in the sequence where I correct what I say in this. Because I, you know, you can't, this is too important a matter to get wrong. But so then, of course, you have to then start talking about war, the inevitability of war, the, you know, the universality of war. So it ends up going back to the terracotta soldiers, which is, I didn't realise at the time, which is about war being ever present and so on. But also the lives have to continue. So it's called Zofia. You had to find your way without breathing, and you did. You walked, surprised how easy now it was to leave the world behind.
But then the usual torments came. You find your mother again, stepping off the boat, a handbag with its handle worn or broken. No shoes, no coat, no language she could speak. And that was where it started. London and peace. Peace after war. But not, you said, for her. You had to listen to each recounted horror, the agreed-on vase of flowers left in a window, a sign that it was safe and no Gestapo searched the house, but how this time the plan went wrong, and fear too big to understand entered every life. You stepped inside my dream to tell me with a kind of pride, your words a muddled rush, how death had come, how foolish all your fears had been, and wrong. The song you stumbled through on your accordion, how everything made sense. The fumbled facts, your father's Bible, the burning books and maps, the camps. Even the European stain found its settled place. There was no pain in your voice, nothing like a cry or moan. You were still the social man I'd known, warm and garrulous in company. You told me all of this and then embraced me. Today I had to cycle to the street by Primrose Hill where, one damp night, MacNeice lay listening to the cutting down of trees, clearing the hill's crest for light artillery. The view prepared, searchlights probing heaven for the bacilli of war. But that was then. Your then still seems to me a now. Your plan when you got back from China and Xi'an, where you'd seen the terracotta soldiers facing east to guard the old Qin Emperor, was to concentrate on the inward journey, but not as far as this. I have your house key, so I lock my bike and open up your flat, the camel rug, the piles of books and knick-knacks, your shadow puppet, a dozen Chinese lamps, the garden overplanted with exuberance. I walk from room to room, opening doors, babbling about tiling and parquet floors. The estate agent suggests a change of decor as April flickers sunlight on your desk. The final envelope, the scrawled address you started and put aside in your distress. She asks about the bathroom and the loo, a better boiler, which carpets to renew, which curtains. She's professional and nice. We talk about the market and the asking price. So what I wanted to somehow get to in the end that was most difficult. The asking price, suddenly, just ordinary thing. That's one of the tragedies of death, isn't it? Is somebody has to think about replacing the boiler. Are we going to rent it? And then the asking price suddenly became, because it's quite dangerous to rhyme nice with price. But you know, it really struck me standing in the half flat. You know, that he would have liked her. And but then of course you've got the asking price of war, the asking price of.
Yes, of lives,
you know.
Because it begins with the mother arriving. And
yes, that's right, the price that she had to pay.
Yeah.
All of those metaphors on the word price.
Mm.
And then, of course, there are details that are incorrect, and I had to find her. She wrote something which is too dreadful to read out, which I then used to correct the story, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very painful, there is a lot of pain in it, and then there's amazing opening line with her not breathing.
Right, yeah. You have to find your way without breathing.
Well, yes, a sort of sense of not being able to speak about what has happened to you, that you have to start again with a new language. And
I mean, you can imagine arriving in London, no shoes, no coat, no language she could speak. And that was where it started, London and peace, peace after war, but not, you said, for her. You know, because then she had to, you had to listen to it with each recounted time. She'd tell the story again and again, he's a little boy, you know. Hearing Polish, not being able to speak it very well himself,
hearing these terrible, terrible stories. And of course, what that does, it sort of, perhaps I'll read another one from it. Upstate, one of the painful things with Mahananda is that his mother's pain kind of always, any pain he had was always nothing compared to hers. And, you know, this is so difficult for survivors, you know, the children of survivors, is how do they, you know, sort of, in a way, I've got to read this poem about that. It's called The Private Ordination. I think it's the first poem called The Private Ordination. That's because I privately, what's called Privately Ordaining, which is you're the person who gives him his name. And then for those interested in technique, it's a rubaiyat. And again, a rubaiyat is A-X-A-A. No, it isn't. It's A-A-X-A. So you get a rhyming couplet again. You see this kind of elegiac couplet. Then you get a non-rhyme line, and then you get that rhyme coming back. So what it does as a form is it takes you forward and keeps pulling you back again. Because the rhyme comes back, it pulls you back. So it's a poem that wants to leave, the form wants to leave, but keeps coming back. That's what the rubaiyat does, I think. It's called The Private Ordination. And when I say, I said your name, what in the private ordination you're told your Buddhist name. So you know, I was privately ordained, I was told my name is Maitreya Bandhu. And your name represents you at your best. It represents what you'd be called if you were the Buddha. If you were a Buddha, you'd be called, I'd be called Maitreya Bandhu Buddha. Well, I'd be the Buddha called Maitreya Bandhu. So
what does it mean, your name?
So Maitreya means the kindly one. And Bandhu means friend, as in brother. So it's the same etymology, I think, as brother. So it means a friend that won't leave you, a friend like a brother to you. Mahananda means, Maha means great, Nanda means bliss. But I'll explain. So that the name is, you can imagine the strength of being named. It's trying to say this is who you really are, and that the rest of your life needs to be becoming who you truly really are. The private ordination. I said your name and told you what it meant, how your life had struggled to that point, what you'd had to suffer, the darkest times, with demons, wrestled without relent. You wept to hear your name aloud, your name, to tell us who you really were, the same and yet transformed, Mahananda, waiting all that time, despite the reach of shame, the dreams you told your psychoanalyst, rages at your mother, despite all this, eggs and china thrown to make her hear, I knew your name should end with happiness. But more than Maha, more than that was Maha, meaning great, abundant, strong, the majesty in weight. But what I emphasised was big as your voice, a fresh start and a clean slate. Because Maha also can just mean big. I want, I was very struck. I wanted it to be a fresh start, a clean slate. So you can rhyme great, weight, and slate, you see. So that word of clean slate then relates to his name, if you see what I mean. Rhyme does something, I think, if you can do it well. It's very difficult to do well, but then difficult to do anything well. If you can do it well... I don't know whether I always manage that. It can do something that no other form can do. It's a shame not to do it in poetry, isn't it? It's the only form you can rhyme in. I mean, you can't rhyme in journalism, can you?
It's interesting, the sense in some of the poems of in the ordination as being a rebirth or some kind of feeling of that. And then... But there's also lots of struggle in that, isn't there?
Yes, kind of terribly sad.
Well, I don't know though, because it's truthful. I always feel if something's truthful, it never feels sad to me actually, because it's just it's speaking to something I know is true, and I don't know if everyone else feels the same. I mean, really, this is a time to bring other people in, I suppose, and see if anybody else would like to ask a question before we perhaps hear a couple more poems. Anybody want to say anything at this point?
I'm quite approachable.
Can I add a thought to the discussion about undone and dispersal? Because it seems you could take the view that we are fragmentary. That is to say, we are a temporary assembly in the form that we have at the moment. But then elements are dispersed. We know the universe is a world mixture of particles and elements. So that particles and elements, whether they be physical or as it were, psychological or an infusion or an influence upon a younger person, a son or a daughter, they may continue.
Yes, yeah.
But the particles are spread about.
Yes, I'm of course aware of that. I mean, Buddhism wants to say it's much more than that. And I want to say that as well. In a nice way. I think there is something... I mean, for me, personally, the older I get, the less I feel I know. Just life is ineluctably strange, isn't it? And but marvellous.
Can I ask something slightly different? You've said about the narrative poems, and I realise that I know what a narrative is in terms of a story, but I don't know what really characterises a narrative poem apart from there being a story. And sometimes in lyric poems there are stories.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Could you say something more about what is the nature of a narrative poem?
Gosh, that's interesting. I don't know that I know. I mean, obviously it's a story. It needs what I've noticed writing it, like with The Travellers from Orissa, I wrote it and it was too boldly a story, so I had to bring the poetry up. What I've noticed in my experience of writing these three narratives in here is there's a different relationship between the story element. I mean, nearly every poem has got some kind of buried story in it, even if it's very difficult to excavate. In a lyric, the story is very quiet, and the poetry is very dominant, if you see what I mean. So you can hardly notice... Some lyrics almost feel like they haven't got one, but if you look at them, they usually have. Very difficult to say anything without a story, I think. But in the lyric, it's more the music and the... Whereas in narrative poetry, the narrative element is brought up, and they're closer together, is my experience. I don't think the narrative should go above the lyric element, but they're held in equipoise more. You're concerned to tell the story more than you are in a sort of standard lyric poem, I think. So you know perhaps I might read the beginning of one of them, because I'll read the beginning of The Travellers from Orissa, because it's sort of a good way of explaining it. And this is a monologue, so, first of all, I had to discover the voice. What happened with all the narratives, that they appear to me in a voice. There's three narratives in this, and they're all in different voices. And then you need a different pentameter for each voice.
You mean the three voices in one poem?
No, in each poem itself is a different voice. Then you've got different voices within them. But I think when you're writing a narrative poem, the tone of voice of the speaker creates the poem more. If you just mean that can happen in lyric as well, but the story comes up more. And so I'll read the first one and say a bit more. This is the first paragraph of The Travellers from Orissa. Tapusa said the oxen stood stock still and wouldn't budge, although we slapped their haunches, dragged their stubborn necks. He said they stood and swung their heads and looked around themselves as if a tiger might be roaming. Tapusa said all the birds stopped singing and the day was still, but Tapusa's head was full of yarns. He'd spin a story time and time again. It got more fantastical each time he did, although he'd bridle if you dared to tell him. I'd long got used to all his talk, the ox, the birds, the unearthly light making us gape and our neck hairs bristle. Every time he'd add another sight, the four great kings arriving with a magic bowl,
a canopy of jewels. A friendly snake wrapped round and round a prince. But it's true we stopped, and it's true the day was still. So that's the first thing I wrote, and I changed it only very slightly. So Tapusa said the oxen stood stock still and wouldn't budge. Right. You see that immediately that line creates the voice. Tapusa said the oxen stood stock still and wouldn't budge, although we slapped their haunches, dragged their stubborn necks. He said they stood and swung their heads and looked around themselves as if a tiger might be roaming. Tapusa said that all the birds stopped in. So it keeps on this rhythm. Tapusa said, Tapusa said, Tapusa said. Then right at the end, the last line is, but it's true we stopped, and it's true the day was still. So that form of repetition like that, I've got a Greek name, I can't remember what it is. But it's true, and it's true. The whole story had to come out of that dynamic between somebody saying something, but Tapusa's head was full of yarns. It got more fantastical each time he did. But it's true we stopped. And it's true the day was still. So that within the voice was this drama of this guy saying this stuff. But it's true, and it's true. So I had to write the whole poem to find out why the but and why the and. What is true then? You see what I mean? So in narrative poems, in a lyric, you might leave it at that. You know, it points at something. You might have left it like that as a lyric. In a narrative, you have to follow up those narrative clues that are in the voice. That's what I experienced anyway. Mm. And I think if I had not said, but it's true, and it's true, I don't think I would have written the rest of the poem. It's that tension between somebody talks a lot, but you don't quite trust. Somebody won't talk, but has experienced something.
And now that you've read that bit, I have much more of an idea of it as theatre.
Do you? Yes, yeah. It could be performed by an actor. Yeah. I mean, the final dramatic narrative, Aaron's brother, is even more so. It's like a speech from a radio play in which the other character never speaks. I wanted a narrative that somebody's talking to an individual who doesn't speak back. And you see, as soon as you have that drama, you have to create, why are they not speaking back? What would happen if someone was talking to you quite a long time and you didn't answer? What would they be doing to you? And of course, what they'd be doing is poisoning you, gradually saying something to you that makes it impossible for you to speak. They're telling you something you shouldn't know. They're telling you something that disturbs you so that you let them talk more and more. And then you have to solve that drama.
Yeah. Yes, that's a kind of rhyme of the Ancient Mariner.
Yes,
poem,
that's
isn't
what was sort
it?
Of in the back of my mind.
Yes,
yeah.
Really wonderful to read. Well, I think we should finish with a poem to end, and so you can decide what you'd like to read to finish. And it's been a really lovely conversation, hasn't it? And yes. Lovely to hear these poems and have Maitre Bandhu unpick them a bit. So
perhaps, if you don't mind, I'll finish with two little ones.
Yeah.
Is that all right? Is that enough time?
And
then we can... a sort of slightly funny one, just to show you that... Someone said to me, they're terribly sad. I said, they're terribly sad. I said, no, I can be quite funny in life. So I'll read a slightly funny one and then a more serious one to finish. So this first section of the book is a Buddhist section. The second section is elegies, and you have a section of poems about my childhood in Warwickshire. And then the last section was supposed to be mainly love poems, except nobody noticed that. It's not surprising, really, when you read them, but it's supposed to be like around love, but no one has noticed it about it. But then I thought, so I'm going to read this one, and it's called I Thought of Love, which you'd think it would be a good giveaway. A little tiny one. Again, it's one of those little lyric-y things that takes forever, and nobody's noticed it. Anyway, so I'll read that one, and then I'll finish with one for the Buddhist section, which is... This has got nine rhymes on the word you. Yeah, I think it's like that. Called I Thought of Love. Today I thought of love. It made a sighing sound, as love is wont to do, old or new, tender or untrue. Today I thought of love, then thought of you. Today I thought of love and tried to be profound, like Baudelaire or Camus. Je t'aime, et tu, the usual ballyhoo. Today I thought of love, then thought of you. Today I thought of love and our old stamping ground in far-off Timbuktu. Your entre nous, smiles I should have seen through. Today I thought of love, then thought of you. And then this is...
Still a bit sad.
Still a bit sad. I can't stop myself. Sad but nice.
Another rave review. Sad but nice. On the back of the next one, isn't it? It's interesting that though, today I wrote that poem backwards. So what came to me first is today I thought of love, then thought of you. Today I thought of love, then thought of you. It wouldn't have been a poem apart from the word then. If I'd said, today I thought of love and thought of you, that's not a poem, but why then? Today I thought of love, then thought of you. That then is sad. And what happens is that then, through the poem, very short poem, eventually becomes smiles I should have seen through. Today I thought of love, then thought of you. You know what I mean? Actually, the whole poem is based on then. This final one, which will have no explanation, it's called Two Birds for Kabir. Yeah. Two Birds for Kabir. A tree was growing in the sky on which two birds were darkly perched. The air was blonde, the earth was grey. The tree was silver like a birch. The tree was like a winter tree. No leaves were gathered round the base, nor did it bow in sympathy to make a shrine or sheltered place. One bird was on a higher bough. She watched the other eat the fruit that plump within a holy now grew as an everlasting truth. And as she ate, the juice that dripped was falling into empty space in shining Devanagari script, like hot tears on a cella's face, or beads from a broken rosary. And so they perch forever there, two birds upon a rootless tree, one eating, one in silent prayer.
So thank you very much, Maitre Bhandari. Wonderful.